Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Polinelli, only on LA Talk Radio.
Did a show for him last week, and I still miss him. And Rick, if you're up there watching, and I know you're listening, as you were a constant listener of the Writer's Block after your music started opening us, we all miss you, and hope you have a good time. Well, no matter where you are, someplace you might be down there, you know, shaking hands with all your friends. You don't have time to worry, but I would be one of those friends, Rick. Okay, welcome to the Writer's Block. This, of course, is LA Talk Radio. My name is Jim Christina. I am your host for this controlled madness hour that we have on Thursday nights at 6 on Pacific time. And I'm looking at my friend and business partner, Mr. Richard Polinelli in Fruta, Colorado.
No, you're in Idaho. I'm in Colorado.
I almost did it again. And, of course, my effervescent co-host that has been with the show for almost 7 years now, Ms. Bobby Jean Bell, who is hiding out someplace in downtown Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hello, Bobby.
Hey, I think this is show 351.
See, I told you, Jody, she kept counting. I didn't.
I think I was putting it up on the website today, getting ready to put up the podcast link, and I think I wrote that it was 351.
which makes it about 332 books.
Well, 351, I don't count the ones that we did best.
So right. I just, oh, so it'd be 351 books.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's live shows?
I believe.
And of course, somewhere out there in the San Fernando Valley, we have the dulcet tones of Mr. Henry Park, who will be joining us and giving us all the useful and somewhat useless sometimes information about what's going on in the Western world. Hello, Henry.
Well, hello, Jim. Greetings, everybody. I've got a lot of good news about four new Western TV series. We've got one already available now. Another starts tomorrow. The third starts a week from today, and the fourth premieres in 10 days.
Wow.
Now, has anyone else?
We lost you, Henry.
Uh-oh.
Henry? Henry? Oh, my God, what was that?
To see the rest?
There he is.
AMC is trying the same deal with That Dirty Black Bag. They give you episode one. I saw it through Amazon Prime. But you have to subscribe to AMC Plus to see the rest. The difference is they'd have to pay me to watch the rest. It's shot in Spain. Leone's old sets look great. Some of the art direction is good. Some of the photography is good. But there's not a moment I believed any of it, not one single character I cared about. But see what you think, because I'm a crab.
Okay.
Now, tomorrow, Outer Range begins on Amazon Prime. It's a contemporary Western fantasy or sci-fi show. It's a little hard to tell the genre because the thriller is very mysterious. But Josh Brolin is the head of a ranching family trying to hold things together when a big hole opens up in a field. There's lots of good people in it. Lily Taylor, Will Patton, Imogene Poots. It's 8 episodes. And in a week, on the INSP channel, the Western-adjacent reality show The Ultimate Cowboy Showdown returns with Trace Adkins again hosting. It's back for a new season. This is one of those rare reality competitions where the people are nice and what they're doing is interesting and really challenging, you know, real cowboy work. I haven't seen any of this new season, but I recommend the show. And in 10 days on Epix is the premiere of the 8-part series, Billy the Kid.
Right.
Yeah. Have you seen any of it yet?
No, I haven't, but I've seen a couple trailers. They look phenomenal.
They do. It's eight parts. It's from writer-producer Michael Hurst, who also created The Vikings and The Tudors, among others. He knows his history, and he knows how to make history entertaining. He's a Brit, and he has an unusual approach. He's telling the Billy the Kid story as an immigrant story. And Billy is the son of just-off-the-boat Irish immigrants.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I've seen the first episode, and I really enjoyed it. It's very, very interesting, good stuff. Also, for any of you who are in California, from Thursday, April 21st through Sunday, April 24th, it's the TCM Classic Film Festival. And here are a few highlights. Friday, they show The Gunfighter, and Ben Mankiewicz interviews Bruce Dern. Saturday, that's always exciting. I had lunch with him, and it took 4.5 hours. But
I worked with Ben Mankiewicz.
I'm sorry?
I worked with Ben Mankiewicz.
Oh,
At WCSC-TV in Charleston, South Carolina in the 90s.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt when you said his name.
No, that's fine. No, I've had much briefer lunches with him than with Bruce Dern, but I'll eat with either man anytime. Oh, Saturday they're showing The Tall Tea, and Sunday they're showing High Noon, discussed by Coop's daughter, Maria Cooper, and country music legend Marty Stewart.
Oh, Marty Stewart.
Yeah, I love his stuff.
Me too.
And let me just say something about me and Western Roundup. Why has there been no new Roundup for months? And the reason is I've been the Western film editor of True West magazine for years, and now I've recently become a twice-monthly contributor to the INSP channel blog.
Right.
So with other commitments, I'm now writing a new article every 6 or 7 days. So I'm posting a new Roundup finally this weekend. It's going, and what it's going to mostly be is links to all of the articles I've been writing for True West and INSP and all the writer's block reports I've done over the last 6 months. So once again, it will be true. You can read all about that and so much more at www.henryswesternroundup.blogspot.com.
Thank you, my friend. And we'll be talking to you first of next month.
Outstanding. I'll see you then, or hear you then.
Yeah, buddy. Talk to you later, Henry. Thanks for joining
us. Take care. Great.
Bye. We have actually a very exciting author that made history fun. And a part of history that I've really never followed much. And I'm going to bring her on right now and kind of let her explain herself to y'all, being a good Texas girl. Welcome to her. Actually, you know what? I'm going to let her kind of tell you about herself. And please welcome to the writer's block for her very first visit, and one of which I hope will not be her last, Miss Jody Hadlock. Hello, Jody.
Hi. How's everybody doing?
We're great. And your new book is The Lives of Diamond Bessie.
Mm-hmm. Right here.
And it's about an 19th century woman of leisure, as it were.
Mm-hmm. And it's based on a true crime.
And it's true crime.
True crime. It's a historical fiction, but it's also mystery, but it's more of a why done it than a who done it. And it's also a ghost story. So
it's a great story. It is a great story. Thanks. And it's like I told you on the phone the other night, I never really thought about following the prostitution aspect of the Old West. Although I know a lot about it, I never really followed any of the except for Squirrel Tooth Alice and a few of the big ones, you know, around Virginia City and Tombstone and stuff.
Some of the madams were, you know, they were pretty wealthy and they roads and they were pretty well off, but then of course they were also shunned by society.
Well, sure. But they dressed nice.
Yeah, they dressed nice, had a lot of nice.
And they had jewels and they had money and they had, but the only thing they didn't have was, you know, recognition in the town.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, of course, as we know, the good church-going ladies didn't want them parading around downtown.
Yeah, a prostitute, when she was out, was very careful not to acknowledge anybody on the street unless somebody acknowledged her first.
Exactly.
Yeah, that was a big no-no.
Yeah. Well, for obvious reasons, apparently.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about your book. It was a fantastic read. I got through it in about a day and a half, and I just ripped through it. I couldn't stop reading it, and that's very unusual. But when it's a good story, I won't stop. And this was a good story. So give us a little bit about your book, and then we'll get a little bit about more about Jody.
Okay. Well, it's set of historical fiction, but also mystery, true crime. It's a story that I learned about a long time ago that just fascinated me. There's never been a novel written about it. It's based on real people and true events. So it's Diamond Bessie was a real person. That was not her real name. It was something else, but for pretty obvious reasons. But she was a demi-mondaine. And there's, like I said, it's based on a true crime. I don't want to give away the plot twist, but it just was a story that fascinated me and that I never let go of me. And so it was a very long journey to get to publication, but it's I'm glad that it's finally happened.
I think that one of the points you made in the book, which I found interesting, not only did they change her name when she went to go live with the nuns, as she was a pregnant 16-year-old, instead of calling her Annie, they called her Elizabeth. And then Bessie came, of course, it was a short derivative of Elizabeth at the time. And so that's where that one came from.
Well, and I fictionalized that because not much is known about Bessie leading up to the time she became a prostitute. So the part is fictionalized. But what I research on, what was, plausible, what would happen to a woman in that situation who had sex outside of marriage. And then, if she became pregnant, then what would happen? And that just led down, to the convents for fallen women. And so that's how the plot developed from that. And then as far as her being a prostitute, I found the memoirs for three 19th century prostitutes that were fascinating. They were riveting. And so I mined those for all they were worth. So it's a very accurate portrayal of life for a 19th century prostitute, mainly at the first class parlor houses. There were different levels, and was at the first class house.
Well, just as now, the girls don't want to be walking the streets.
Oh yeah, that was
that was big even back then.
Oh yeah, yeah, and you did not want that was the worst to include just because I couldn't, but. They were the lowest. Well, you had streetwalker, but then just above that was a crib. And it was basically like a row of just small rooms with a mattress and a sheet that wasn't washed for weeks. And, so it was very, and they obviously weren't paid very much. I even read somewhere that there were prostitutes in New Orleans that would actually walk or, carry a mattress around with them. It's just, stuff like that. It's, that's really, sad, tragic, but that's what happened.
But this book is inherently about Bessie, Diamond Bessie, and she's called Diamond Bessie for a reason.
Yeah, because she garnered jewels from her paramour.
She got her jewels, yes.
And she was known as being, of course, beautiful and dressed very well, which, of course, the prostitutes that the demi-mondaines, it sounds so much more elegant than a prostitute. But they could do very well for themselves, which was interesting because I even read for research, I came across this paper about how prostitutes were some of the wealthiest and freest of the women. They were really independent, not depending on a man, but of course they needed a man to make their living, but they still were some of the freest, but then they were shunned by society. They lived in a separate world, part of the underworld. One of the memoirs that I read was The Underworld Sewer by Josie Washburn. And so that's kind of an apt description of it, The Underworld Sewer.
It was it's an interesting story, and I managed to find a picture of Bessie and posted it up on Facebook.
Oh, okay. And
it was a very well done drawing. Wow, and she quite a
newspaper, and that's the first one I saw. But I think the other one, probably the one that you saw, is probably closer to it. But she was only seen in Jefferson for a few days before the tragic event. And so I don't know when these drawings were made. I don't know how long after. So it's based basically on, a fleeting image of her probably. Though in the newspapers at the time, there's a very accurate description of her, but I don't know what that.
I think my husband.
Whoever that was, excuse you.
My husband just opened the oven.
I thought Betsy may have come in and said hello there for a second.
I think that
usually it's Richard's dogs.
Dinner's in the oven. Sorry about that. He's kind of far away, so I'm surprised he's speaking on the dinner room.
And I've got back here. I've got Mrs. Jefferson in 1868. And that's the Mitty Stevens, which is actually a very famous story about that. It burned on the bayou. And so that represents that. But that's what the wharf looked like in the 1860s, because Jefferson was an inland river port, which when I first heard about Jefferson, and I was like, an inland river port, you know, in Northeast Texas, what? But the steamboats could come up the Mississippi to Shreveport and then cut over to Jefferson. They cut through the Caddo Lake and the bayous and get all the way pretty far inland into Northeast Texas.
Well, that's how they shipped their cotton.
Cotton was
huge. So I mean, they had as many inland ports as they could get. They had.
Mm-hmm. And of course, when the trains came, that was pretty much the death knell. Of Jefferson. It's back in the 1860s. It was larger than Dallas. Dallas was just a little blip. It was about 1880 when the population in Dallas took off and Jefferson starts to nosedive. Because it's after they blew up a log jam on the river it made the water start to recede. And so there wasn't enough water for boats to make it all the way to Jefferson. So with that and the trains, and so now the town's about 2,000 people. But it's a huge tourist destination, and it has like 20 hotels and B&Bs for a town that's only 2,000 people.
Well, what do you think, Richard? You're sitting right there in front of it.
Well, it's not too bad of a view here. You know, I'm just hanging out here on the balcony.
Well, for you. And when I first saw Bobby, I thought maybe she was in New Orleans because
it looks like
a
hotel.
French Quarter.
There was a huge New Orleans influence on Jefferson because of the steamboat trade. And people would come from, Jefferson had one of the biggest Mardi Gras celebrations outside of New Orleans. And so people would come over from Shreveport. They would come from all over for the Queen Maeve Ball in Jefferson.
Well, it looks like Northeast Texas. I lived there. I've lived in the Tyler area for about half a year. Okay. And it's, you either have trees or you have a town. There's no open. There's no opening unless there's a town there. You don't have openings in the trees. It's just trees everywhere. So, it looks like a nice little town.
Yeah.
Well, little, I think, is the operative word here.
Is it little?
I was looking at that behind Bobby a little earlier, and I too thought it was New Orleans at first. Having gone to Mardi Gras once in my life, I would never go again. One of the worst nights. Fat Tuesday was the worst night I ever spent in any town in my lifetime. I have never been pushed, jostled, shoved, slapped, beated. Oh, my God. Everybody wants to beat you. They throw them from the balconies. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't move without running into somebody or having to say, excuse me, excuse me, excuse me. It takes you 45 minutes just to get into the bar to get a drink, and then another 45 minutes to wait for the drink. It's terrible. It's Mardi Gras is not fun. Well, at least not to me.
This portion of the Writer's Block brought to you by the New Orleans Tourist Bureau.
That's actually true. Hey, we're going to take a real quick break here. Don't go away, Jody. And, of course, the rest of you know the drill. You're listening to LA Talk Radio. This, of course, is the Writer's Block. And we will be right back with you after this brief word from LA Talk Radio. So you want to be a radio talk show host, huh? Well, why don't you get your butt and do just all a day long, Saturdays and Sundays included. They're 50-minute increments, so all you have to do is go to latalkradio.com, click on the link that says Become a Host, follow the easy-to-follow instructions, and Mr. Sam Hassan will be more than delighted to walk you through everything you need to do to get your own radio show started, up and running worldwide with a podcast to follow. That's very easy to do. LATalkRadio.com. Let them help you get your dream alive. LA Talk Radio, you've got something to say. Now let's hear it. And we are back with our guest, Ms. Jody Hadlock. And if you want to call and talk to Jody, the number here is 323-203-0815. And you can call and Sam will answer the phone and he'll put you in touch with Jody and you actually can say hi to a real life author and ex-newswoman and OTV person and dog mother.
I did nonprofit PR for a while.
Okay, there you go.
But she's an Aggie though.
My husband went to prepared to be longhorned.
I'm married to a longhorn.
Well, there you go. Okay. Well, then you're only half bad. There you go.
Yeah, I'm only half bad.
So the question I think I have, and I was asking myself when I was reading your book, is what possessed you to write a book about a murdered prostitute?
When I first learned of the story, it was in Jefferson. And was at the historical museum, and I'd always wanted to write a novel. I just didn't know what I wanted to write about, you know, what I wanted to say. But I was in the back of my mind, you know, looking, you know, what is it that I want to write? And I was at the historical museum, walked down an aisle, and in front of me there was a full page newspaper article about Bessie and Abe Rothschild, and it was in a Dallas paper in the 1930s about a murder that had happened 60 years earlier in a town 3 hours away. And I thought, why was this paper so interested in this? And then I just was immediately intrigued. And at the time I was working as a TV news reporter and anchor in Charleston, South Carolina. This is back in the 90s. So this is before the internet really. And I made a vow that when I moved back to Texas, that I would look into it and see if it would make a good novel. So when I moved back, I got a job as the main anchor at the Fox affiliate in San Antonio in 95. That's how long ago. And I did research for 2 years. And I mean, I immediately knew that it was a good story. It had all the ingredients, but it took a lot of research. And I just never left for a long time. I was frustrated because I didn't have the right point of view. I realize now, you know, how important it is to have the right point of view. It's absolutely crucial. And then, of course, the research. And then when I came back to it, and as I started writing, I realized I need to do more research. I mean, the research, you know, it could never end. At some point, you have to say, okay, I'm going to start, you know, writing.
Yeah.
So it was just a very long journey. It just never left me.
Huh.
Yeah. And so I'm really, really, I mean, it's been 30 years.
It was intriguing that you kept up with your first person from the start of the book all the way through the end of the book, even after it was not exactly a spoiler alert, but even after Bessie is murdered, we follow Bessie in her first person format I don't even know if she's a ghost. I think her spirit's still here because she wants revenge and she hasn't gotten it. And she doesn't want to leave.
I dare say she haunts you.
Oh, no, that's for sure.
I think she's looked out for me. There are coincidences of things that have happened that just are not explainable other than that she's looking over me. And I had things, freaky things happen. Like I was, Ed Levine's one of the characters who's friends with Bessie. I won't say when, but I... was, you know, sitting here thinking, okay, what role is she going to play? And I felt, and I was alone in the house. I felt this very strong presence, so much that I literally turned around. Ooh. And I was like, okay, Edla, you're going to have a prominent role in this book. And she does. And I love the.
Yeah. It's pretty tight. Yeah.
Yeah. And I just, it really affects me for some reason. I mean, when there was one scene where, I mean, I literally was crying when I was writing the scene. I don't want to say what it was, but there were times where it was very emotional writing some of it. But I've heard that if you don't feel the emotion, then the reader's not going to feel.
Exactly. Go ahead, yeah. Rich.
No, I want to jump in. We know that Bessie and Abe are real people who actually existed. Just a rough number, how many people in this book are actually people who have lived that you were able to actually connect to her?
Oh, A lot of them. All the main characters. Well,
okay.
I didn't have a list of the names of the prostitutes at all the brothels, and I didn't know, you know, a lot of this in the afterword of explaining this, and then I'm have a lot of details on my website. But I say in the beginning, because a lot of it's fictionalized, I made up a lot of people.
Okay.
But certainly not her family. All that's real. And then from through the second half.
Right. In Jefferson.
Most of the people were real. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the question, reason I went that way is, when you're writing a piece of fiction, which is historical fiction, but you're using real life people, how hard was it for you to balance getting them to, you know, continue the story, but staying true to who these people really were?
That's tough. You can only do so much research, and then you have to like really put yourself in their shoes and, mm-hmm. and, you know, think like each character, and, you know, I had to do that with, even though it was in first person, she's observing a lot and then getting into the heads of a lot of people in the second half.
Yeah.
So it was really just, that was one of the things that I found that I needed to go deeper. And I know we'll talk about writer's block later on, but that's one of the things that I learned.
Go ahead, Rich.
One of the characters is a U.S. Senator. I think he actually makes the
Senate. Congressman.
Congressman.
No, he was a real person, and he really did. He really was one of the defense attorneys.
Right.
Did you
do any research as far as his speeches or any of his writings to kind of get a feel for how he would? Okay.
Yes, yeah. I did. And because he was a congressman for so long, for like 1875 to 98? A long time. And then his son, Charles Culberson, became a senator when they were, at the time they were appointed, they weren't elected. But he was Attorney General of Texas and then Governor of Texas and then a U.S. Senator. And so between the two of them, they served literally like 50 years. David Culberson was in the Congress, in the House, and Charles Culberson was always in the Senate.
Right.
Yeah. But there was a lot of information. I looked at, you know, his voting record, some speeches he made about different issues, a lot of stuff which I could not use, but informed, you know, the way he was as a person. And he was kind of a colorful character. So there's some descriptions of him, you know, of him that helped.
I know that when I wrote that book, was a real person. With the exception of the guy who wrote the journal that the book is, each chapter starts with a journal entry. But as you're writing these characters and you're giving them dialogue and you're giving them breath and life, I always sat and wondered, did I get it right? Did I get it right with this guy?
Mm-hmm.
You don't know because you don't hear their voices.
And you don't know how things are going to be received. And then this is my first novel, my first book. You know, it's interesting to get feedback from people.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, Bobby Jean was one of my big pushers on Bugles and the Sun. She loved that book. But there's a real quick scene in there where they're just about the 2 days before they hit the Little Bighorn. And they're at a camp one night. And this guy comes over to John Connolly, who is the character that is the only fictional character, and they're sitting talking, and he stops, and he's got his rosary out in his hand, and he's playing with it, and he goes, "Do you believe in God, Johnny?"
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "I don't know. Yeah, maybe, probably. Why?" He says, "I think we're going to need him."
I like that.
and I can imagine somebody sitting and saying that, you know. Mm-hmm. So.
Oh yeah. Yeah, that's but what I had to do.
Yeah, the whole book, it was like, oh, God, did I get this guy right? Is he right? You know, don't know.
And I went through so many drafts, and the story kept evolving. And some it got to the point in ways that I didn't even originally imagine, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and so I will say, by the time I turned it into my publisher, I went through, it's like, I knew I went through two final edits before I actually turned it in for the copy edit. I mean, I worked with freelance editors because I just felt that it still needed a little bit more. And so I did those two final ones before I turned it in. And then I felt really good. I mean, it doesn't mean it's going to be everybody's cup of tea, but I felt good about it.
What does your editor say about the book when she got it?
Oh gosh, which one? I worked with a woman named Bridget Boland. She's in Chicago, and she's the one that I worked with on multiple drafts. She's the one who really challenged me, and she's the one who helped me find the right point of view. Uh-huh. And so that really helped a lot. And because I will say, even though I'd read a lot, when you sit down to write, you know, to create yourself, you know, it's just a totally different ballgame.
It's a different process.
And it took me draft after draft after draft. And so many, I lost count, but I wanted to get it to the point where, I just wanted to write an engaging story. So it took a long time.
You did. And the book is engaging.
No, thanks.
For sure. You guys want to go ahead and take our last break and then start on the process? Are we good with that, Bobby?
Yeah, works for me.
So you're awfully quiet up there in the corner.
I'm trying to figure out how to jump in.
Well, jump in anytime you want to.
No, that's okay. You want to run?
Well, I really want to stick with process after the break, so why don't you go ahead and ask your question now. Or plural questions.
Well, I guess they're kind of more comments. I wanted to say that one of the things that I really appreciated as a reader are some of the elements that you brought in, the suffragette movement. That it was not really polite for women to be reading novels. That was very new to me as a reader, with so much wonderful literature being written at that time, and thinking that women weren't supposed to read. The references to Clytie, I thought.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. you bring in locations, but also the culture of the time, whether it's the rules that she first learns about how to act in her first brothel, what the rules of etiquette are, which I found fascinating. You just give us, and she travels, and you have us going, you know, we're in Chicago during the fire. I don't think about women in this kind of position necessarily traveling unless something has really dried up for them. And I think of that more like women in the gold fields or places where the population is moving someplace else and they kind of have to go. I mean, she went to New Orleans through, you know, certain times of the year, and she was in Chicago. It was just all of that was, to me as a reader, and it also made her very personable. And I could really connect to her and see her situation. And then to both you gentlemen, you know, recently we talked about the O.J. Simpson trial, and I couldn't help but think, like, this is like a trial of the century at that time, and partly why it still fascinates contemporary people. Because there's still unanswered questions, and it's I'm sort of embarrassed that I didn't know about her. I think I'd like to think that I know a lot about, you know, icons in Western history and such. It's like, how did I not know about Diamond Bessie? Well,
in the 90s, I used to say that it was the O.J. Simpson trial of 19th century Texas.
Oh,
but now it just seems to, you know, so long ago that I stopped, you know, saying that. But that's exactly what I compared it to.
Well, you actually could take the O.J. Simpson trial and drop it in the middle of the Diamond Bessie trial, and it would fit, and vice versa.
Oh, yeah.
It's amazing to me, the wordage and some of the transcripts that you've got in there of the original trial. They're almost word for word things that you hear now if you watch, like, court TV or whatever, You know, it's the judges or admonishment of the attorneys, and the attorneys getting up and yelling and screaming, and, you know, I object. And, you know, the attorney's saying, I don't know what you're objecting to. You know, I object to you. And, okay, everybody's in contempt. Go ahead and take our mid-hour break, and we'll be right back with you. This is LA Talk Radio, The Writer's Block, and we'll be back right after this brief message from Tuscany Bay Books.
You say you've written the end on a book that makes Rowlings look like Jack and Jill went up the hill, that makes Tolkien's look like a trip to the store, and finishes a series better than George R.R. Martin? But you don't know how to get your book into the hands of readers?
No!
Well, look, before you throw that manuscript in the trash and set warp 10 for get me the hell out of here, go to TuscanyBayBooks.com, click on the submissions tab, tell us all about your book, and we'll get back in touch with you, and we'll help you get that thing formatted, edited, get a cover for it, and let you know how to market it too, so that you can do the most important thing, write your next book. That's TuscanyBayBooks.com. Go there today.
And that's it. And we're back with our guest, Ms. Jodi Hadlock, and we're talking about her new book, The Lives of Diamond Bessie. 19th century prostitute, 20, a hooker back in the 1870s. Interesting point, and I wanted to bring this up a little earlier. A lot of people don't know, and people that do know try to, they look at the Westerns and they think, oh, those, you know, all the hookers used to hang out in saloons. Thank you for playing. No hookers hung out in saloons. Saloons were for men only, and that's the only people who were allowed in. The dance girls and the gambling houses is where the prostitutes normally picked up a lot of their customers, and the upstairs and the gambling houses and the dance halls normally were brothels, albeit cheap brothels.
Mm-hmm.
The expensive brothels usually were down at the end of the street, and they were like luxurious.
Oh, they were palaces.
Oh, and they were well appointed. Yes.
Well, in New Orleans, they were on Basin Street.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, and there were some, and then in Chicago, there were some, I read in my research, they were palaces.
Yeah, and New Orleans, I know, still had some of the cribs back there they were using for historical purposes. Some of the cribs survived, and they were back behind the French Quarter, but I don't know if they survived the floods. And from the Hurricane Kate or what it was, Catherine or whatever.
Katrina.
Yeah, Katrina. Yeah. I don't know if they should or not. I do know that the cribs are still out there behind the main street. Mm-hmm. There's about four or five of them still out there. And then Tombstone as well. Yes.
I was just going to say, I know we're heading for process, but I also found another tidbit that you shared. Who knew that Madams would provide you a letter of reference? And as you were traveling, you know, you would present that, or that they were listed. She has a book, the Chicago Sporting and Clubhouse Directory.
And I've got it over here in my bookcase.
Yeah, like who knew?
Well, also who knew that the prostitutes used to clear out in the wintertime in the northern cities and go south?
Yes, they did. Well, it makes sense, though, because, okay, Chicago, really, really cold.
Oh, yeah.
And New Orleans, warmer, and Mardi Gras. And they needed the influx of women to handle all the business. So it may, when I found that out, I was like, well, it makes sense. So right. Yeah, they did that a lot.
Right. Well, we know that it took you a couple of years to write this book. When did you start working on it? At what time of the day do you do your writing, and are you comfortable doing your writing?
I like to work from coffee shops, even though I don't drink coffee. I only drink tea. But I think it maybe comes from having worked in a newsroom. And there's been studies done that the ambient noise of a coffee shop is really conducive to focusing. And I can shut everything out. I mean, it just, I can. So the quiet, I don't like it to be too quiet. That bothers me. When I was working full time, you know, I wrote whenever I could. Of course, I had to set this aside for a long time and then came back to it. But I'm very disciplined. I'll get up in the morning and I'll spend 3 or 4 hours in the morning and then 3 or 4 hours in the afternoon, and sometimes I'll do something in the evening. But that's everything. That's either the research, writing, you know, promoting, you know, marketing. So that's everything.
Yeah, Richard's an old newspaper guy. He totally gets that.
Oh yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I think my first book that I wanted to write and was working on, I would do in bits and pieces. I think that thing took me 15 years from when I started, because you get home, you got everything else you got to do. You find an hour here, you find an hour there, and it takes a while.
Yeah. It does. But I've heard that. I've heard, read, you know, authors saying, you know, even if you just have 10 minutes, mm-hmm. you know, because it does, it builds up, and then finally you have a book. But of course, I was going through draft after draft, and the story was it changed so many times. It just kept, you know, evolving. I used to have a prologue, and that was one of the best decisions I made, was to drop the prologue. Uh-huh. I held on to it. I just couldn't go. I was like, I just have, suggesting to not have that. And then I finally let go of it. I don't know why I couldn't let go, but then I finally did. It was one of the best decisions I made.
Yeah, I think had we been working on your book at Tuscany Bay, we would have recommended you get rid of the prologue as well.
Yeah, yeah, because since you've read it, the beginning of the second half was the prologue.
Right.
And it just, yeah, but now it's just, now readers either love or hate the plot twist. There's like no in between.
Love it.
Well,
if you like
with the plot
story, then you're going to love it. But but most of the feedback has been, you know, not to know too much going into reading
right.
it.
Right. Well, most of your plot twists, I mean, the feedback and the plot twists are all real. I mean, they all happen. So, yeah. I mean, how can you dislike them? You know?
Well, and I didn't want it to, and I've been asked this, I didn't want to end. I didn't want that ending. Mm-hmm. I wanted the entire story, and I wanted it to end on something a little bit more positive. Because some readers have questioned that about, the story continues, and they didn't really understand why. But it's called The Lives, plural, for a reason.
Right.
And
right.
to me, it was the way the story needed to be told. And I just think as an author that you work on it so much and it evolves that I think a reader needs to pretty, you know, trust that this author had, this is the way the story needs to be told. I know everybody has their, thoughts on, oh, well, I would have done it this way or that mm-hmm. way. But, you know, you didn't go through the process of this evolving and, you know, to get it to the point that it's at, that I just really, I do that. I just authors when I enjoy the story and not, fret so much over, you know, whether that, you know, they should have done this or that.
Sure, sure. Okay, I'm going to announce now that our guest tonight, guys, Jody Hadlock, is the only guest we've ever had on the Writer's Block that actually made notes about Writer's Block. So with that being said, Jody, briefly, you have about 2 minutes.
Okay.
And have you had writer's block? Yeah, apparently you have. And if you have, how did you get out of it? Go.
Well, I hate to diss writer's block, but I don't know if I really believe in writer's block that much, because now I understand what may have been thought of as writer's block. It was really more that for me that I needed to do more research when I... Well, a few things. The story wasn't fully formed in my head. I didn't have the right point of view for a long time, and I needed to go deeper. I mean, each of those things, they were things that I had to learn. That, like, I was so frustrated when I didn't have the right point of view. And I'd sit there and I couldn't do anything. Okay. And I thought that's writer's block, but no, I didn't have the right point of view. Because when I finally got that, when my editor, Bridget Boland, challenged me, and when she did that, and I froze, like, I don't know if I can do that. And she said, well, just try it. And then I wrote the first chapter in 2 days. Now, that's not the same first chapter, but so I had the right point of view. And then I also realized when I started writing, I'm like, I did all this research on the case, and I had this outline, sat down to write, and I hadn't really thought about the creative logically and not creatively. And so you know, I realized that I needed to go deeper, and I needed, and then when I started writing, you know, I realized I needed to do more research on certain things about 19th century life. And so if I'd get to a point where I was stuck, thought I had writer's block, it was, you know, I learned to just make notes. Like, I needed to focus on the story. And I could get hung up on a detail. I mean, like, well, I need to know this detail. No, I don't have to know this detail right this minute. Make a note that, you know, come back to it. But I needed to get the story out. So I had to get rid of those things that were blocking. But now I realize that. So at the time I didn't. And I thought, why can't I get this? Why is this so difficult? And I would just beat my head on the desk. And that's why I write down these things that maybe it's one of these that you need to address. Now, it doesn't mean that when I sit down to write my second book that I'm not going to be scared to death. Can I do this again?
Right.
But I, now that I know all this is behind me, that I feel more confident that, and I know what I need to, like, unblock myself, if that makes sense.
Okay, and that, ladies and gentlemen, is the most non-committal answer we've ever had on Writer's Block on this program. And with that being said, we're going to take our last break. You're listening to LA Talk Radio. This is the Writer's Block, and we'll be back right after this brief word from Creative Edge Publicity. Okay, you've written a book. How are you going to get your name out there? Well, the folks at Creative Edge Publicity will. That's their job. Brand from the ground up. So you are known in your genre and within the writer's community. They'll do this by using relationships with contacts they've made in TV, in radio, podcast, and publishing to get your name and your brand recognized. So why are you waiting? Contact Creative Edge Publicity at www.creative-edge.services or email Mickey Mickelson at mickey.creativeedge@gmail.com. Creative Edge. It's your work and it's your brand. Why would you trust it to anyone else? Creative Edge Publicity. And we are back with our guest, Jody Hadlock. It is now 9:45, which would make it 6:45. Mountain Time, 7:45. Central Time, 8:45. Eastern Time, 10:45. No. Yeah. I don't know.
9:45.
Out there somewhere. The question that we've been asking a lot of our writers at the end of the show, I mentioned this to you the other night, as a writer, and when you finish your book and you've got it in your hot little hands, what do you expect your readers to pull from this book?
Well, and actually, and I just thought of this after Bobby was talking a little while ago, the word popped in my head, complexity. I love to read novels that are complex, that have a lot going on. And that's why, you know, I have some Irish mythology, Greek mythology. You know, I use the Clyde as a motif. That's what I really enjoy when I'm reading a novel. So I'd say the complexity, and, you know, I wanted it to be an engaging story. Obviously, who doesn't want it to be an engaging story? And, you know, learning a little bit about history, maybe about the women's rights movement that I have in my book. I mean, I learned when I was researching and when I found out that Susan B. Anthony gave that speech, it's in my book, on that date in Chicago when Bessie lived there at that time, was a prostitute at a brothel, and Susan B. Anthony gave that speech on prostitution, the great social evil. You know, it was just crying to, you know, because I had thought of it being in Bessie's little world, but it's in the broader context of what's going on in society. So I hope that people take away from it's, you know, it's not just Bessie, but it's what was going on in society at that time. And then I hope readers realize how far women have come since that time, because they had so few rights, so few opportunities, and it's so different now. And, you know, I want them to feel something, mm-hmm. some emotion.
Well, I think, honestly, being pushed down and you know, degraded, as it were, I am totally against it. And as I'm sure Richard is and Bobby Jean, I know is, you know, but it still happens. And it's really unfortunate. There are still men that live in this world that make women second-class citizens.
Oh, and there are many parts of the world where that's...
Oh, absolutely. It's infuriating.
Oh, yeah.
To hear some of this stuff. I mean, some of the most powerful men in the world mistreat people. Well, women mostly, because they can.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they get away with it until they get caught. And then all of a sudden they cry to their mommy and, you know, well, I didn't mean to hurt her feelings. You know, just wanted to cop a feel. Well,
there's always room for improvement. But we've come a long way and paved the way.
Right.
You know, I love Susan B. Anthony and love her.
How many women got a dollar, really, when you think about it? How many women got their faces on a dollar? One.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, incidentally, the ugliest dollar I think I've ever seen. I still have one. Somebody bought my Arab mare when she was in breeding for a dollar, because there's a thing with the Arab world, and you can't sell the horse to breed. It's really strange. So you can sell them for a dollar. But you have to be able to get the horse back if you want after they've foaled. So at any rate, it's a long story. I'll make it short, which means I'll cut it off right now. Okay. Well, Jody, I really want to appreciate and thank you so much for joining us. And feel free to hang out after the show, because we usually hang out and talk for 5-10 minutes.
Oh,
so what are you working real quick? What are you working on?
The second novel will be set in Russia and the U.S., but 1858 to 1880s. I was hoping to go to Russia next year for research, but that's probably not going to happen.
Good luck with that.
And I have other ideas, but they're still in the, you know.
Percolating,
yeah.
Steeping the tea jar.
Yes.
and for our listeners that have enjoyed Paris Afton Bonds on this program, a number of times. Paris has got a new book. If you are interested, it is called Reluctant. Oh my God. Oh, I just did a review on it.
That's enough. Anyway, the Reluctant. Yeah.
Yeah. It's about the Reluctant something or other. I'm sorry, Paris. I know you listen to the show and I love you anyway. Anyway, Bobby, she's looking it up real quick.
It's
about the early 1900s in Juarez and El Paso, Texas, the bridge.
Uh-huh.
And when they had when they used to delouse the Mexicans coming across to work, they deloused them with kerosene and DDT, and a number of them caught on fire. And this one woman, actually, she was a real gal, had created a big stink, and it was like a 3-day war. An insurrection on the bridge. They virtually closed the bridge down.
Oh, how interesting.
It's called The Reluctant Rebel. It's available now on Amazon. And I did a review for at Paris. And the sales are pretty good on it. So thank you, Jody, for joining us.
Thank you.
Next week we have Carrie Peresta. She's returning. Her last show was 5/13/21. And the book that we reviewed last time was The Deadening. And a great book. And she's got, and of course, the book, he will be sending it to all of you people. I think Russ is next week. Is that correct? Yes. Until then, for myself, for Bobby Jean Bell and Richard Polinelli, Mr. Jim Bell, who occasionally sticks his head in and says, hi, for Mr. Hey, Jim, how are you?
He's at the oven. I can smell dinner.
For our engineer / owner, Sam Haston of LA Talk Radio, who allows us to bring this to you weekly. And, of course, the bookie without whom this show would not be made possible. We are out of here.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Polinelli, only on LA Talk Radio.